Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. This month, the Biden administration's interim national security strategic guidance and the British government's integrated review set out Washington's and London's long-term foreign and security assumptions and priorities. In this edition of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black, author of Military Strategy, A Global History and The Tory World, talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about whether these plans depart from or continue a coherent Western strategic worldview.
Professor Black, how does the current integrated review fit into the wider theme of British strategy and foreign policy over the last 50 years? Is this a definitive break from the past, or do you see many, many strands of continuity?
Well, I think that the review is an impressive one. I think it very much focuses on the tasking that is necessary before you discuss individual investments, in particular military systems, and tasking, or what I would call the prioritisation that is key to strategy, is very much here. So I think it's impressive. I think it's better than the last two reviews. And I think it's impressive. I mean, the one thing that I am disappointed in the public discussion is that March 2021 has in fact seen two strategic reviews, and I don't think I've seen any British discussion of that. It doesn't surprise me. We don't always do these things very well in Britain, but I mean, the Americans have brought out the Interim National Security Strategic Guidance, which is very instructive. It's President Biden's as it were, first take at trying to bring forward a strategic document. And it's interesting. I do think that it would have helped if some of the commentators had read it. I mean, clearly the timing is different to the British one in that the genesis of the British one began last year, and the key people in it who've done a fantastic job were working at it last year, whereas the Biden one is obviously, although he must have anticipated what he wanted to say before he became president, the actual formal process of that could only begin after the inauguration. But they're each interesting in terms of the need for a rules-based system, in terms of the need for prioritizing between potential tasks and potential opponents. They are both of them represent a pulling back from commitment in the Middle East, I think it's fair to say. I mean, the American one emphasizes that it's committed to Israeli security, but it doesn't represent the kind of interest in nation building and widespread interventionism that we saw in the 2000s. And I think the British one, it's fair to say, doesn't either. And there's quite a lot of parallel between them.
Well, you're right that most commentators, particularly in Britain, haven't picked up on them. Would you say the two knit together neatly and that the British Integrated Review shows a keen awareness of where the Biden administration is? Or, I mean, I just wonder to what extent they are two jigsaw pieces or to what extent they are parallel worldviews which have some touching points.
Well, they're parallel, but they fit together very well. The American document is shorter, I mean, it is an interim review, but I think it's fair to say that the principles underlying both are the same, which obviously is advantageous for both powers. There is always the issue when you look at a strategic document, either a public one or a non-public one, there is always the issue about the difference between enunciating goals and priorities in public and focusing in private on the really vexed and difficult issues of prioritisation in implementation and in, by the very nature of things, if you were looking at, for example, the military end, you can't deploy the same naval task force in different oceans at the same moment. But I think it's fair to say that the kind of documents we're looking at are not ones to deal with, to do with implementation. They're to do with ones of setting out tasking, and I think they fit together very well.
I wonder to what extent, with an integrated review, you have different component parts, to what extent one is dominant. Foreign policy presumably leads, and the development and defence and security fit into that. I mean, is there such an obvious hierarchy, or is it more a jostling mosaic of competing and contradictory forces?
Well, it's obviously both. I mean, in a sense, the public sphere is very much the latter, and indeed one of the unfortunate aspects is that that can produce a cacophony of special interest that drives out the question of tasking. By a cacophony of special interest, one means that different branches of the military demanding particular attention, and or those groups that are linked to or independent of but nevertheless related to the particular security concerns of specific parts of the world also making a understandable noise. It's quite understandable. That's their form of soft power and their form of politicking. But I've argued, I mean, I think you've read my book on military strategy and global history, and I understand that, that book was certainly read by at least two key members of the group that drew up the British review. I mean, it very much argues that the key thing in strategy is tasking rather than planning your strategy around the weapon systems you already have or might invest in. And I think that, I mean, you might call that, if you like, foreign policy coming first. I mean, I would say that security and foreign policy are part and parcel of the same thing. That if you read both the British review and the American review, they both emphasise the significance of reconciling a rules-based international order with the pursuit by their respective powers of the national interest. And they both make it clear that the national interest is in part a matter of seeing a rules-based system prevail. And I think that's entirely correct for Britain and the United States. It wouldn't be correct, obviously, if you were looking at it from the perspective of some other powers who have contrary views. So I think that the British and the Americans have conceptualised very well a linkage between an internationalism and a nationalism. And I think that to that extent, I mean, I think there are other things to praise in the documents, but I think to that extent they are both quite impressive.
I'm looking particularly for areas of historical continuity, and one of them is what we might still call the continental commitment, which is now phrased pretty explicitly in terms of fear and suspicion of Russia. Is that the most obvious area of continuity?
Well, we're talking here about the British.
Yes.
Right. Well, first of all, we've got a Conservative government in power, and it's an internationalist government. I think that's true of both, it could be said fairly to be true of both the Conservative and the Labour government since 1945. Within that context, there are obviously, just as the same thing that there are for Labour, there are tensions within conservative views on foreign policy. I discussed those in the book I edited, The Tory World, which was published in 2015, and I think the same thing is still the case, that there are, within conservative views on foreign policy, there are both interventionist traditions and ones that are much more cautious of interventionism. And to a considerable extent, that potential tension was held in suspense during the Cold War because pretty well everybody could agree that there was a need to be able to protect Britain and its allies from a potential Soviet the major government, which had foreign policy issues to do, a tiny majority in foreign policy issues to do in Bosnia, in Kuwait, and vis-a-vis the European Union, and didn't really have to deal very much with considering either Russia or China, because in those periods, both China was relatively quiescent, economically growing, relatively quiescent internationally, and Russia was in fiscal freefall and militarily was not maintaining its forces. Then we have a period from 1997 to 2010 of a Labour government, and during that period of time, the Conservatives did not have to consider or assess particularly the extent to which their, as it were, grand total of requirements over security and foreign policy would stand the actual hitting, you know, the ground and the friction of real world and real budgets and the constraints of other powers, including allies. So the Conservatives had, as one does when one's in opposition, a little holiday from history. And, you know, the principal foreign policy debates, which were the extent to which Britain should or should not get involved in the Iraq War, were not ones that divided in any significant way the Conservatives. Now, after 2010, you get, of course, the Cameron government coming in, and you see the very different tensions within conservatism in the debate about the intervention in Syria, in which the government, the Cameron government, which had already intervened rather disastrously, but that's another issue, intervened in Libya, proposed to do the same in Syria, and there was significant opposition from within conservative ranks. And I think that captures the fact that there is no one view of, by conservatives on foreign policy, just as there's no one view by Labour people. And one of the interesting things, the tension which we've seen, or the dissension which we've seen over the last week, which is the one about the extent to which trade should be seen as a battleground with China, is that that brings forward two differing views among conservatives. So to rewind back to your question about the continental commitment, both major British political parties are committed to NATO. It is NATO that is the envelope of our commitment to the security of Eastern European countries who are members of NATO against Russian aggression, and that hasn't changed with the strategic review, and it doesn't look as though it will change. I mean, the principal problems there are posed not by what Britain does. The principal problems are, A, posed by, obviously, Russia and its, particularly its development of hybrid methods of activity as seen in Ukraine. But also, it has to be said, the way in which European partners in NATO are not necessarily particularly robust or reliant. Some are. Poland, for example, is. But you know, there is a well-established view that Germany is strongly neutralist and, in fact, quite favourable to Putin in some respects, not just with fuel imports. Spain is unreliable, etc., etc. And this then poses a question that, for a lot of commentators in Britain, they've had, as it were, an opportunity to ignore the problems that exist in terms of the security of Europe, because they've been able for the last few years to blame President Trump for whatever they don't like, or to focus on President Trump. But President Trump is now not in the government of the United States, and it's about time people took a little more, including many of the people that have been very benign in their assessments of some European powers, notably Germany, took a very much more serious line as to looking at the extent to which policy there is compromising the defence of Eastern Europe, and therefore the NATO alliance, and therefore the wider interests, both international interests and rules-based system, but also national interests linked into that of Britain and the United States.
But what do these first statements of the Biden administration, and of course we're in very a new territory with that, but what indication do we get of the level of commitment to European security from Washington, D.C.?
Well, I think the United States is concerned about Russia. I mean, obviously, the Americans are not in a position to fight a two-power war against both Russia and China. The most aggressive state at the present moment might not appear to be Russia. And therefore, and there is also, let's be clear about this, it is a reasonable point. I mean, President Trump made the point, President Biden will make it more tactfully. But nevertheless, what President Trump was saying was correct, that the Europeans wish to have the guarantee of the United States, and yet only a relatively small number of European powers were paying out what they were on defence, what they were supposed to be paying out in accordance with NATO guidelines. And again, you know, I don't wish to be regarded as a Germanophobe, I'm not, but it has to be said that it has been, under both the Schroeder and the Merkel administrations, it has been absolutely pathetic that one of the wealthiest countries in the world is spending so little and has such a parlous situation. It expects other European powers, particularly those of the Mediterranean or places like Hungary, Italy, Poland, Greece, to obey its fiscal and other strictures, but it seems to imagine that it can get away with really floating on others' backs as far as defence is concerned. So if I was President Biden, I would be quite cautious about, as it were, trying to load all the burden onto the United States.
Well, there is a danger, isn't there, though, that in Germany in particular, but other European countries too, there'll be a sigh of relief that Biden is president now, the sense that, you know, he will continue to remain committed to Europe's defence, and that therefore the American commitment means that other nations, particularly Germany, can have a free lunch, essentially, on America's back. Is that the real danger now? And if that is the case, is there a movement in the Democrat Party in Washington after a bit to say, actually, you're having a laugh, and they will take a more Trumpian view that if you're not going to pay your way, you can't count on American support?
Well, I think one mustn't. I think that's an interesting question, but you mustn't look at it in a vacuum. I mean, as I mentioned, the United States is, as it were, not just the global currency in reserve; it's the global power in reserve, which acts to guarantee democratic powers to which it is allied, places like South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Israel. It has to be said that it doesn't have to necessarily articulate the same view that President Trump forcefully said, but it can have that view, but it can just simply be driven to other directions by the need to focus on other threats. And, you know, it's in a dynamic relationship with the threats that are thrown at it. I mean, let us say, for example, that within the year, I don't know, Venezuela starts attacking Colombia because, you know, it's got an army and it can't afford to maintain it, and it's in a really difficult situation. I mean, its own fault, of course, Venezuela. The United States can't just simply sit around and decide it's going to do nothing in a case like that. So I think that in a way, one of the points, and, you know, if I was an American policymaker, I would feel pretty fed up about it. One of the points is that there is a degree of narcissism among a certain number of politicians on the continent who both moan about the Americans and yet nevertheless expect that they can blow a whistle and the Americans will do whatever they want them to do. And I think that that's unrealistic. I think it's unrealistic whether you have a Republican administration or a Democratic administration, whether you have somebody who is a America first of the nature of President Trump or an American first of the nature of President Biden. I mean, President Biden is quite clear that the rules-based order is linked to I mean, he has to look at what are the principal challenges. And quite frankly, you know, given the wealth in Europe, it is reasonable to expect the Europeans to do more. After all, President Macron has said that he wants to see a stronger European military presence and constituent. I mean, I think quite frankly, he's going to get nowhere with that. But that is his position. And, you know, the Americans might well say, well, you know, let's see what this means. I mean, you know, let us say you have instability in a part of Europe, maybe again in the former Yugoslavia. What are you going to do about it? Don't assume that we are going to put it first among our priorities. I think that's an entirely reasonable thing in any, and any strategist would say yes. I mean, it's a second order threat, both to the global order and to American national interests. And, you know, if it inconveniences or embarrasses local players, regional powers, that's their problem.
Well, returning to Britain's role and in its commitment in Europe for a moment, is there such a thing, in your view, as a post-Brexit strategy, or is it just the strategy that has emerged since Brexit in relation to events as we find them? Is there anything ideological, as it were, about the defence and foreign policy post-Brexit?
I'm certainly old enough to remember an age in which we were pulling back from east of Suez, and in which we cancelled the CVA-01, the big aircraft carrier through deck carrier, plus the proposed sort of follow-up, in which we left our military bases in Aden, in the Gulf, in Singapore. And that was very much then we focused on NATO tasks and the North Atlantic with a detour to the Falklands. And that was very much foreign policy and defence policy in the 1970s and 80s. Well, it's not Brexit that took us back east of Suez. We were already going back east of Suez in 1991 for the Kuwait conflict. We then obviously went back very much as well in 2003. We also sort of invested in two new supercarriers, which were quite clearly designed to project power. And they're certainly not designed for the Mediterranean or the North Sea or the Baltic. So in a sense, again, it's, I'm not talking about in your case, there's a lot of lazy journalism out there. I mean, it interests me that, I mean, one of my major fields is defence and foreign policy. And it always strikes me that you get some pretty poor writing on defence and international relations, including in a lot of what are the so-called quality journals. Now, it's this dynamic in foreign policy and defence can be seen from the beginning of the 90s. There were one or two precursors to it, but then it can be seen in practical terms from the beginning of the 1990s. It is clearly now something that, and again, linked to that, there was already a degree of, how should one put it, there was already a sense on the British part of a impasse, even when we were members of the European Union, an impasse in which the British were not keen on European defence arrangements of a major form separate to NATO. The British went along with obviously trying to have a bilateral agreement with France, but essentially they were not keen on the idea of a European dimension to NATO that was separate, because they were worried that this would lead to the detaching of the United States and Canada from European interests. So the British were already worried, anxious, moved away from the Euro-Federalist idea prior to Brexit. They were already greatly interested on the east of Suez prior to Brexit. And to that extent, what we are having now is bringing together in a new document what has been there for a time. The last strategy review was rather botched and became essentially one about sort of weapons. I really didn't see an adequate presentation of the foreign policy aspect. But I think if you had been looking, for example, at the foreign policy of the Cameron administration, from 2010 to 2016, there was already a great interest in British relations with China, British relations with India, well before Brexit.
I'm very interested and want to pick you up on something you said a moment before, which was about the two aircraft carriers, Queen Elizabeth and Prince of Wales, you know, clearly being designed for Indo-Pacific waters. But of course, they were originally commissioned in Gordon Brown's time in the Labour government, and then we had all these years of the so-called golden age of Chinese-British relations under David Cameron and George Osborne. Do you think that actually there has been a long-term view stretching back to the early years of this century, that a return to an East of Suez Pacific engagement because of the rise of China was a high likelihood, and that was a major reason in the commissioning of these very expensive carriers?
First of all, I think the carriers themselves, the rationale was not specifically against China when they were commissioned in the 2000s. And as you may know, I don't think it's any secret, the Cameron government seriously looked at cancelling the carriers. I mean, I know that's the case. And they were thwarted by the contract. The contracts with the AE systems were such that they would have paid out a vast sum of money even if they'd been cancelled. It might still have been a good idea in the sense that there might have been better things to spend the subsequent money on, but that's another question which we could discuss on another programme. And as I think you know, I've published several pieces on the question about the carriers. I'm afraid to say that there were particular interests involved, but there was also the tensions within the Navy. The British Navy is essentially divided into four tribes. There are the Marines, who are essentially an autonomous tribe. There are the submariners, there are the surface warships, and then there's the Fleet Air Arm. And these groups vie very much with each other, and the, shall we say, the Fleet Air Arm lobby won. It presented its case, it won, and then, you know, the Navy found itself stuck with it, because in many senses those sums of money spent on other warships would have been possibly, well, I would say definitely, better. And then obviously it came towards destabilising the naval budget and then the defence budget as a whole. But that's a separate issue to what we're talking about, which is that's an issue of weapons procurement that went out of control precisely because people hadn't thought through adequately the idea of balanced military expenditure, long-term developments in technology, and in this case, anti-ship missiles and smart mines, and also drones and other missiles that could be fired from platforms which don't require to be as long as a carrier designed for manned aircraft. So there's that issue, and separately the issue of foreign policy. Now, you can look at this several different ways. If you were an American policymaker, you can take the view that, yes, you would like a British commitment in the Western Pacific Ocean, Southeast Asia, but that actually you would prefer better the British to, as it were, commit in other areas where they would be releasing American resources from, so that they could have more resources in the area of confrontation. Other areas could be the Mediterranean, Europe, the North Atlantic. You know, you could discuss that as and when. So you shouldn't necessarily see the ability to deploy these carriers. Now that we've got them, we've got to use them. There's no two ways about it. It'd probably be better if we could sell them to India, but let's leave that to one side. But now that we've got them, we actually obviously are going to use them, and they are used as a manifestation of British influence. They are, like most military systems, best if they are not actually needed in actual is in actual combat, that your military systems can have a very high rate of attrition and you could be stuck with nothing, as well as obviously the life of the loss of life, which is is considerable and needs to be thought about in terms of the duty of care to members of the armed forces. So I would not see the decision to build the carriers as proof of an earlier anti-China policy.
Right. Not proof.
I think you're assuming there a level of planning that and a level of cohesion, which it would be nice to think existed under the Labour government of the governments of the 2000s. I don't think that that is in fact the case, or let me go stronger than that. I know that that is not the case. I think that there is obviously a wish to use.
Right, so no premonition of trouble to come. Is it? It's a simplification, but is there some truth, though, in the sense of, well, we've got these carriers now, set carriers now, so we've got to use them, and therefore we have to build a foreign policy around that, and that extends to some extent the tilt towards Indo-Pacific.
It's due to its fiscal significance, it's due to the importance to Britain as allies of, in particular, but not exclusive, not limited to this, of Japan, Australia, India, and crucially the United States. And it also reflects the United States' concern and commitment to the region.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's also part of the British attempt to engage with China, in the sense, because clearly, we have a whole host of issues and problems, and these would be best addressed in terms of, as President Biden knows, in terms of being able to talk to the Chinese, and you don't have to love people to try and move forward. I mean, there's going to be no prospect, for example, of dealing with climate change issues unless in agreement with the major other powers of the world, of which the Chinese, with their economy, fueling up to be the leading manufacturer, is clearly the one. There are a host of, if you're going to have a rules-based international order, then really it's a question of hoping to persuade China to be part of it. So, there's a whole list of factors there, and one shouldn't assume a either-or model of international relations. You're either at war with somebody or you're their ally. I know you're not doing that, but I'm just simply saying that is not how strategy works. We'll put it like this. It's a very naive level of strategic analysis and presentation, the two not being coterminous but nevertheless related. So clearly it is not in our interests to see any power aggressive, still more a power aggressive against our allies or states with which we have good relations. So us taking a role is in part designed not to win a war, but to avoid a war and to encourage everybody to, to talk. And again, as I said, they don't have to love each other. That's a very naive view of international relations.
Well, during the Cold War, one of the primary roles of British Armed Forces, and particularly the Royal Navy, was to protect the North Atlantic and the North Sea.
You could argue that.
Given the amount of the Navy budget that has gone into these carriers and the assumption that they're going to be spending a lot more time in the Pacific than they are in the Atlantic, does this risk a diminution of what might be seen to be Britain's key role, and are we not just doubling up what America is doing in the Pacific in any case?
For Britain of the Navy. When you're referring to protecting the security of the North Atlantic, you're referring at the present moment to a strategic challenge from Russia, not from Mauritania, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Now, in the event of, and one doesn't wish to say this, but we need to be clear about this, in the event of Russia attacking Britain and its trade links and taking part in active high-level hostilities against us, we would probably go nuclear, and we would pretty quickly. So the question of where our aircraft carriers are is not particularly an enormous consequence in that particular moment. And those aircraft carriers are not fundamentally designed for anti-submarine warfare. And in fact, in terms of value for money for anti-submarine warfare, they're pretty poor. But that's another question entirely. You're assuming a ready trade-off. You're assuming the fungibility of military resources that is very easy. In other words, you either have a warship in the Sea of Japan or you have a warship in, say, the Barents Sea. It's not quite the same. It's not quite like that, because what warships can achieve in particular areas and vis-a-vis what your opponents might or might not do varies. So you moving your warship does not necessarily have a proportionate effect somewhere else. And again, I think that's fairly easy to understand. Well, I hope listeners understand that readily. If there was hybrid level conflict with Russia, in other words, we're talking not about full-scale war, but the harassment of merchant shipping in the North Atlantic, it would be presumably from Russian submarines. It could obviously be from aerial refueled long-range bombers. I'm again not convinced that the location of two aircraft carriers, both of which are quite vulnerable, would necessarily be the first way that you would try and fight a submarine challenge.
Well, you mentioned earlier about the nuclear deterrent. The decision was already taken to renew Trident, but the integrated review sprung something which was a surprise to many people, and that was increasing the number, the cap of the number of nuclear warheads that Britain would have. And should we have been surprised by that, and what is the thinking behind it?
So I would see that in terms of a robust deterrent. I think that it shouldn't be regarded as surprising. I certainly don't think it's the kind of thing that is going to, you sometimes see people expressing horror that this is going to in some way encourage states like Iran or North Korea to press ahead with their nuclear development and deployment. I think that's just ridiculous as an argument, quite frankly. These states are, and also exaggerate the significance of what Britain is doing. I also buy into this argument totally that we're in a more troubled international environment, and in that context, if you are going to have a deterrent, you want it to be as strong as possible.
I'm very struck in this conversation about an integrated review of foreign security, defence and development policy, how much of the focus is on the Royal Navy. What should we see as the role of the other branches of the armed forces? In previous podcasts, for example, we discussed whether the days of the tank were numbered. Is there really reassurance on that front? And where should the other branches of the armed forces take heart or be alarmed?
In the Baltic Republics in particular. So we can expect troops to be there. We can expect troops to be used to support out-of-area commitments, so classic one at the present moment is the defence of the Falkland Islands. I think where I would say the review, for fairly obvious reasons, did not discuss to an extent that possibly I would do, and I did do in my military history of Britain, is the role of the army as the ultimate guarantor of the civil authority. And we've obviously seen that most clearly in Northern Ireland, but I used, when I was lecturing on this, to ask people what was the principal deployment of British forces the winter before the Second Iraq War, Second Gulf War, and of course they wouldn't know, and you know, it was to deal with the ambulance strike. And if you look at the use of armed forces, they've been used for civil emergencies. Well, let's take this a stage further. Civil emergencies include what we hope not to see, which is large-scale lawlessness or breakdown of order on the British mainland, or a recurrence, for that matter, of the Northern Ireland Irish Troubles. And I feel that that is a very important use of the army, that it has that capability. You can't really use either the Navy or the Air Force for that. And I think there have been times, it's too easy to forget that, the riots in London before the Olympics, the situation in Nottinghamshire where the Chief Constable warned about the difficulty of maintaining policing there. There have been situations where it's been unclear how robust the British state could be in order to protect its citizens from lawlessness. So that, I think, is an element. The service, which I think is the one where it's hardest to see a rationale in which it should be equal to the other two, is the Air Force, because once you moved to the nuclear deterrent as being a matter of submarine launched, and you ceased it being from free-fall or indeed guided munitions from aircraft, then the ultimate strategic role of air power declined. Now, there's still a role for air power, there's no doubt. You know, I've written the history of air power, which one of the things I asked towards the end is it the case that the rising cost of air power means that for most states it's become obsolescent, that the aircraft are so expensive you can't readily use them or risk them, or the rate of depletion would be too great because you don't have very many of them. And we could separately ask the question, of course, as to how far there are different and other attractions of using non-manned aircraft, though there are, of course, significant costs, control costs and maintenance costs in non-manned aircraft drones, as you know, as well as in aircraft. But I would have thought that if you were thinking about, sorry, it's a horrible sentence, but I'm tired. I would have thought that if you're envisaging the three services, the one that is most, redundant's the wrong word, but most problematic, I would say, is the Air Force. I just say that is as a separate service, that you could have an argument. I mean, obviously, the whole point about aircraft carriers is you having aircraft there. You could argue that what we should do is have an army air force, which in a sense we do already, and you know, so that is in support of forces on Mm-hmm. And we could, you could argue, and that's something I discussed in my book of Air Power, that air power, it may well be something which you should regard as operationally significant rather than strategically significant.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, that's perhaps an argument we will have to have another day.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of three issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.
The long-term trends in foreign security policy following the integrated reviews. Thank you very much.